This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The Vermont Agency of Education has just submitted a state education plan to the federal government. It explains how Vermont plans to improve the learning of children living in poverty and shrink the achievement gap, and it addresses federal questions about how to do this. It explains how Vermont will implement the federal Every Student Succeeds Act, or ESSA. And these federal rules come along with money, over 3% of all the money spent on education statewide, and more in some high-poverty districts. ESSA replaced a federal plan you might be familiar with, No Child Left Behind. But what exactly does it mean for the state, and what's in this plan? Well, we're joined today by Vermont Education Secretary Rebecca Holcomb. Welcome back to the program, Secretary.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Is submitting this plan a requirement of the federal government?
Yes, it is for anyone who wants to participate in using these federal funds. And just to be clear, this was really a civil rights law that was designed to provide support for states so that they in turn could provide support for historically marginalized populations, populations that by virtue of historical discrimination or disadvantage, economic deprivation, weren't able to demonstrate the success in school that we would hope for all Vermonters.
So you say it's required for anyone who wants to participate, but the state is not required to participate?
Well, I suppose the state could choose not to accept the federal funds that its taxpayers have paid taxes to the federal government for. But I think the reality is in Vermont, we've decided that it's an important tool that we have to help shine a light on places where we've done some phenomenal work, but also to try to highlight some of the disadvantages that some students bring to school and how we might be able to help those students thrive and achieve success and go on and grow up, participate in careers, go to college, and hopefully help build a strong Vermont.
So this does come along with money, and federal dollars are attached to it. I mentioned that it's about a little over 3% of all of the funds that are spent on student education in Vermont we're not talking about higher ed here. So how does that money get into the state? Does the state have to have its plan approved and then the federal dollars come attached with that approval?
Yes. So just to be really clear, this isn't the totality of federal dollars that support education in the state. It refers to what we call the consolidated federal programs. So it tends to support things like local resources to support special initiatives that really target areas where the local district has identified a need, particularly for a disadvantaged group of students, or it supports statewide professional development in both public schools and independent schools designed to improve the quality of instruction. So it's that sort of bundle. It doesn't address the special education dollars, for example, per se. And in order to receive and then spend these dollars, we need to have a very clear plan for how the state proposes to implement the federal law as written. So when the Every Student Succeeds Act was passed, Vermont began the process of working with stakeholders to figure out, given what the law required, how would we figure out, first of all, what our Vermont goals were and how we wanted to support quality education for every child in an equitable way, as outlined in our education quality standards, and then look at what are the opportunities in the federal law to really advance that Vermont agenda by partnering and doubling the use of those dollars to advance our Vermont goals.
And is this the first time that the state has had to submit a plan under ESSA?
Under ESSA, because it was just passed, yes. And in fact, the third was the first state that the U.S. Department of Education was willing to look at these plans for how states would do that. And Vermont was determined to hit that first state. There'll be another round coming out in the fall. And this plan, if approved, will replace our No Child Left Behind work.
Can you just delineate sort of give us a sense of how these are different between No Child Left Behind, Common Core, and ESSA? Because, I mean, these are all words that swirl around, and it's hard sometimes to figure out where the distinctions are.
Right. I think that's a good question. So the No Child Left Behind Act was the previous iteration or version of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. So the actual act is the Elementary Secondary Education Act. And that's a law that is designed, it's a civil rights law that's really designed to target additional supports and also additional accountability, sort of shining a light on where inequities exist to help ensure that states are really taking care not just of some children, but taking care of all children and giving them the opportunity to thrive.
And that's from 1965.
Yes,
and that is not a new
act. That's been around
act.
For a long time. And so that has been in place, but in every successive reiteration of it, it's been finely tuned. And I think with No Child Left Behind, which most of your listeners are familiar with, there was an effort to sort of shine a brighter light on performance as measured by standardized tests, and that was the accountability for making sure all of us were really attending to disadvantaged populations and making sure that they were making good progress. I think in Vermont, our own history was a little challenging with No Child Left Behind. We were a state that started off by setting fairly ambitious standards relative to other states. And so it was inevitable that at some point, every single school, public school in the state would be labeled a low performing school because every single child in every single grade didn't score as proficient on every single test. And because we had high standards, if we'd picked very low standards, obviously we could have achieved that benchmark, but it wasn't what we did. And so it became somewhat absurd in our context, so we were actually quite pleased to be able to move on to the new version of the law, the Every Student Succeeds Act, because it lets us really reboot and move away from the good school, bad school conversation and move towards a more sensible conversation around how do we use what we know about learning in our system to try to help schools improve learning for every child in a continuous way. We know that many of our schools are wonderful schools and many of our schools have extraordinary strengths. Some also have some pretty substantial areas of improvement. And in fact, every school has something on which they could do better for some of their children. So by moving away from that good school, bad school labeling under No Child Left Behind and its single focus on just standardized testing, we're hoping to force a more rich, more robust conversation about what we care about in Vermont for our schools, what we know about what we care about, and how we can help our communities try to do better for every child.
Listeners, we're talking with Rebecca Holcomb, Secretary of Education, and we're looking at the state's plan to do those things she was just talking about to try to close the achievement gap between students living in poverty and those who are not, to try to make sure that students are succeeding and finding a way into the job force and finding a way to higher education. Secretary Holcomb, is there an overarching philosophy to how to do those things that you were talking about to challenge schools to be better, to help them to be better for all students and to help all students succeed? Do we have sort of an overarching philosophy to how that might happen?
I think the philosophy is what I just said. It really is about continuous improvement. We realize that, again, every school has some strengths. Many of those reflect the strengths of their communities, but we all have room to get better. And the way we make strong schools for all kids is by being willing to be open to the idea that there is something we can do that will improve learning for children in our care.
And does that look different for every school? And is the agency looking at each individual school?
So we do. And one of the things that we can do and the kinds of conversations that happen are different at different levels. So at the agency, we would look at data for across the whole state, and that would help us understand both how are we doing as a state overall, how are we doing in terms of our equity gaps overall, and what are we seeing in terms of evidence that we're actually improving the performance of our system overall. So we would ask sort of statewide questions, and we would also use it diagnostically. So one of the things that we've been working with our systems this year on is instead of just playing out what were your overall scores, actually looking at what overall scores were in relation to critical variables like what proportion of the student population lives in poverty. And what we see is there's some extraordinary variability in the state. There are some schools that really work with very challenged populations but are still demonstrating some pretty impressive results. So that's an opportunity for us to say, what is it we can learn from this particular system that might be really effective that then we can bring out and share out with other systems so that they can learn from that experience? We also know that different schools, just by virtue of where they sit in the state or what their demographic profiles are, may be dealing with different challenges. Some of our communities are in the process of integrating large numbers of students, for example, who come to this country, come to Vermont, not speaking English as a first language. Some of them had very little formal education prior to coming to Vermont. So we wouldn't expect those schools to have a lot of students who went out and hit home runs on the test the first year. That they may be doing very well and they may be making tremendous progress, but what they need to do to help those students do even better is fundamentally different from another school that maybe has a very high wealth population, very high scoring on average, but has extraordinary equity gaps. So they may be doing very well on average, but what we can see in their data when you begin to take it apart is that particularly their students who live in poverty in that community aren't making progress the way we'd like to see. So, you know, what's the right next step of work is different for every school. At the state level, we can see those larger patterns and ask those questions. What each of our communities will have to do is take the same data, but locally, and disaggregate it in the same way and ask, you know, what are we seeing in patterns here that tell us about where we need to divert our, or direct our resources to get the greatest learning for the children in our care.
So then what is the state's role in helping a school to do that? If we're relying on communities to say, we need to make some changes or here's how we can improve, what is the agency of education doing to then support that school or to say, no, that's not, you're not on the right track?
So first of all, there are several pieces to this, and I don't want to get too much in the details. And some of this are part of our Vermont Accountability State Plan, and some of it are part of what we are working with the federal government, which directs a lot of our school improvement resources. But we are in the process of putting together two tools that we think will be incredibly helpful to our local systems. The first is sort of an online data dashboard, which will have pretty robust information. And everything in it has to meet certain criteria. It has to be something we can count because it's a quantitative assessment. And so we will gather data in four big areas. The first is academic proficiency, and that's what people tend to think of when they think of standardized tests. But in addition to standardized tests, we will include some data for each system related to whether their students are enrolled in post-secondary opportunities 16 months after graduating, whether they're in the workforce, looking at lagging indicators that are measures of once kids leave school, are they actually experiencing success beyond school? Because frankly, at the end of the day, that's almost a more important measure of success than how you do on your 11th grade test. And so that's a really key improvement that we see in this plan. We also will look at graduation. We'll look at health and wellness indicators. We'll look at some of the kinds of personalization opportunities our system is providing. We're very interested in whether systems equitably have access to dual enrollment, for example. We know that's a critical tool, particularly for kids coming out of high poverty backgrounds, to reduce the cost of college. We see some areas that are making great use of that dual enrollment option, some that aren't. We want that public so systems can say, hey, if I'm seeing my kids aren't going on to post-secondary, am I also seeing that they're not doing dual enrollment? And maybe there's a relationship there. So providing more comprehensive data that helps them look across a spectrum or a broader set of indicators, I think will help support more nuanced conversations, and it will be public, it will be transparent, that will support communities as they're having that. And I think parents want to know that information as well. And then the second piece is we're putting together what we call integrated field reviews, which bring teams of educators and even students to look at these schools. They'll be informed by these online data snapshots, these quantitative snapshots, but they'll also focus on some of the more qualitative work we can see around local efforts to move those other indicators. In our federal plan, we are emphasizing academic proficiency, and that's because we know that if children can't read, write, and do math well, there really isn't much opportunity for them beyond school. We know that if we're not giving them access to some kind of post-secondary opportunity or good career, we haven't served them well. And we know that one of the steps to that is not just giving them one 11th grade test, but letting them start to personalize their education so that if they want to go into the armed forces, they can take a step or a test that moves them that way. If they want to go on to college, they can take one of the college entrance tests. If they're interested in some kind of post-secondary pathway to a career in tech certification, we could look at industry recognized credentials. So we've designed a plan that we think meets the goal of making sure communities actually have data to look at the progress of their systems, but also it has enough flexibility in it to meet individual needs around different paths that students might want to take, and enough flexibility to help schools be flexible about what they need to do next, which is different in different communities.
We got a couple of questions from people who have some thoughts on that idea of personalized learning plans and how to sort of direct learning to different kinds of kids. Janet says all parents, including parents of students with disabilities, want their children to achieve academically. What specific accountability measures are in Vermont's ESSA plan to track the progress of students who have disabilities, those with an IEP, an individualized education program? And then Kari, a Vermont educator and parent of a gifted child, and Carol, a gifted and talented consultant, posted to say, as we understand it, under the new Every Student Succeeds Act, ESSA, legislation requirements, Vermont needs to declare how it will recognize and teach gifted learners. How are the needs of gifted learners addressed in the new ESSA and Vermont's new state education plan? So different demographics, but both questions sort of asking, how do we help different populations of students achieve?
Right. Well, I'd hesitate to call them different populations because many of our disability students with disabilities are actually gifted. So I wouldn't want to say that those weren't inclusive groups as
Absolutely,
well.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I think one of the things that we do want to look at, first of all, is disaggregation of data. And one of the things that we do is we do report out performance separately for different subgroups. So, for example, if a system is large enough, and one of the things that we will be doing, first of all, is reporting it at the SU or SD level, supervisory union or supervisory district level. And part of the challenge, frankly, that we have in Vermont is that because our systems are so small, we haven't actually had access to that data before, because at the school level, we can't report the data publicly for students with disabilities in many cases, because there aren't enough students with disabilities in the school system at that particular grade level to report and still protect, you know, privileged confidential information. So out of deference to student privacy, that data has been invisible. But the reality is, when it's not visible, we don't know how those students perform. And I have to say, I am concerned that lack of visibility has sort of taken us off the hook for being accountable for the performance of those students. Again, when we disaggregate the data, one of the things that we've noticed is that there are schools in the state where students with disabilities outperform students without disabilities in other schools at the same grade level. So it's not that students with disabilities can't learn. It's just that we need to hold ourselves responsible and accountable for making sure they do learn. And we do think reporting out at the supervisory level will allow us to make this data transparent in more systems. And it's also appropriate, frankly, because services for students with disabilities are now served out of the supervisory level. So it's bringing that data out so people can actually track and monitor the outcomes and the progress of those students. We've also made some efforts to ensure that the assessments that we use, we've picked assessments, the Smarter Balanced Assessment in particular, because it has, well, not perfect, it has so many more modifications built into the assessment so that it is accessible for more students with disabilities than some of the previous assessments that we've used. So we see that as a positive step as well, so that we can get a better assessment of their progress. And obviously there's students who still need more specialized assessments, and those are still in place as well. So I think it's about transparency and saying that all students, including students with disabilities, they are our Vermont students, and we are responsible for making sure that they have access to the same opportunities that everybody else does. And also breaking it out across different indicators. I'm concerned when I see in our data that students with disabilities are less likely to pursue post-secondary opportunities. That's a problem. We need to think about that and think about how not encouraging students to move on may actually preclude them from access to higher wage, high growth industries or careers where they might actually do very, very well, because the real world is not the same as sitting in a classroom sometimes. And then also thinking about how to use some of the tools of personalization to engage kids differently when they haven't been, maybe they learn differently. And, you know, one of the things that we've seen is that particularly under the personalization, some of the flexible pathways work that's taking place, many of our schools are looking for different ways to engage students using hands-on applied learning opportunities, always holding students to the same academic outcomes. Everyone has to be well-educated, but taking a deep breath and looking at each individual child and saying, what's the specific, I'm trying to speak too fast, too much to say, but what's the specific opportunity that will help move this individual child forward? And I actually think that's a nice segue to the question about gifted and talented children, because in the focus on personalization, what we're saying is you can't assume that because some students learn this way, that all students would learn this way. And what we have found is that increasingly systems are coming up with highly flexible local plans for how they want to support the needs of diverse students, whether they're students who maybe have limited formal education or whether they're really extraordinary students who need to be pushed above and beyond through dual enrollment, through early college, through highly specialized work-based learning or independent studies, to try to give students who really need more academic challenge a new place to push themselves and be challenged. And so, you know, again, we don't want to necessarily prescribe that, because what works best may vary from system to system. But what we do want to hold people accountable is not just the progress on average, because we don't want average scores to go up at the expense of, you know, challenge and stimulation for students who are already performing very well, but how are we working at every level for every child to keep pushing and looking at the growth of those children? One of the things the new plan does do is incorporate growth measures, look at a growth measure that looks at your overall progress on the student and school level relative to the rest of the schools. And by incorporating some measure of growth, what you're saying is it's not just how you score, it's how much improvement you're making. And so that also will speak to some of the work of some of the gifted and talented students.
Today, we're talking with Vermont Education Secretary Rebecca Holcomb about the state education plan just submitted to the federal government. We're learning about the structure of that plan, as well as the way the federal government influences state education guidelines. You can also go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. You'll find the executive summary of the plan there. Mark says, Secretary Holcomb, the elephant in the room of education is that labor costs make up about 80% of the total cost. To best accomplish the goals of ESSA, would it not make fiscal sense to add some predictability and standardization to how this 80% chunk of the budget is managed and negotiated? When are we going to move to a statewide teacher contract?
Well, first of all, that's not an ESSA question. That would be a local policy question, and that would be a question to direct to your legislators. I don't see that happening in the foreseeable future.
Does the overall budget have any effect on how schools are able to achieve the goals that are set, though, under ESSA, and that the state has directed schools to do, you know, all the things that we've just been talking about, closing achievement gaps, making sure that every student has opportunities? Obviously, those all cost money. So whether you're attaching federal government dollars or state dollars or local dollars, you know, it all winds up coming together into how we educate our children. So, you know, to Mark's point about statewide teacher contract, sure, that's not something that you can accomplish. But the question of where the money is going and how then we achieve best student outcomes seems somewhat relevant.
Right. And that is something I can speak to. I first of all, I need to be very clear. We made a strategic decision in Vermont to start with our Vermont goals. And there's very little in this plan that isn't also in Vermont statute or didn't come out of the extensive, we had, I think, input from over 2,000 individuals in every single county in the state of Vermont about what they had as aspirations for their schools and for their children. And many of the decisions reflect that input. So to be very clear, the federal plan is a subset. It's a tiny sliver of what we want for our children in Vermont based on that extensive public input. On the other hand, the federal dollars at the state level help fund our Vermont goals and our Vermont accountability. So we are using that strategically to advance a Vermont vision for high quality schools and how we make them possible for all of our children. So that is a big piece of it. And I think it's also important to remember that in terms of the resources that go directly to school districts, it's up to about 6.5%, I think, in our highest poverty schools under this particular plan. They are in addition to dollars to advance these civil rights goals. They are not instead of dollars. So there is nothing in this plan that should supplant or get rid of what is a school's local responsibility to provide for its children. These are dollars on top of a good school that are designed to provide affirmative, positive opportunities for children who live in poverty, children who've been homeless, children who've struggled for a variety of circumstances outside of their control, because kids really have very little choice in terms of where they're born and what the circumstances of their lives are. This is to give a little extra support to those children where they sit in the state to make sure that they too have a chance to take care of the phenomenal educational opportunities that we provide. In terms of making sure our resources are well used, absolutely, that's critical. And the plan will provide some information around fiscal efficiency, around teacher quality and staffing. If we see a system where there's tremendous turnover of leadership, tremendous turnover of staff, I can tell you right out of the gate, that's a huge waste of money, because one of the most important costs is the value and the capital and the training of your teachers. And if you're investing money in the education, professional development of your teachers to become better teachers, and then they turn around, leave, and go to another system, you haven't just lost the teacher. You've lost that entire investment in their quality as a teacher. So really thinking not just about teachers as a cost, but thinking of them as an investment and making sure we make the right investments and then provide enough stability and continuity so that we can retain the value of that investment. And you know, certainly different regions of the state will approach this challenge in different ways because of the geographical diversity of the state. But certainly, I think for many systems, trying to move towards a more unified district structure has enabled them to think more strategically around how they leverage scale and use these resources in a more targeted and consistent way to provide stability.
Well, while we're on this financial topic, let's go to Marcus calling in from Sharon. Hi, Marcus. Go right ahead.
Hi. I heard this morning on VPR that the federal government gives Vermont $55 million, I think is what it was. And I wonder if that's proportional to other states with our with our population? I mean, per student, is that how that's allocated? I mean, compared to a state like Wyoming, let's say, where they get about the same. And then because that sounds like an awful lot of money to me per student, I wonder about the tax that we all pay as families. And I've been told that Vermont spends more per pupil than any other state, and I wonder if that's true or if that's just a wives' tale. I'd love to hear more about that.
All right, so several different questions there for Marcus, Secretary.
So keep me on task if I miss them. The first question I had is that Vermont gets about $55 million on average. We'll go up or down depending what happens in the budget process. And that is driven by the population of the state. So it is proportional to the student population. There is a small state minimum for administrative costs because no matter how many units you have to distribute over, there is sort of a minimum administrative overhead to both manage the plans and the accountability for the plans, but also basically just get the dollars in and get the dollars out. So that is a small state minimum. It used to support, I think, about 9 people at the agency. It now supports about 3 people at the agency to oversee the implementation of this plan. And that is driven by numbers. I think on average, it's a deal. My understanding is that Vermont gets back more money than we actually send into the federal government tax revenues. But I think more importantly, again, this is additional money. This is our commitment to making sure particularly areas that in our context really struggle with pretty adverse poverty and disadvantage associated with poverty, it's an opportunity to make sure that we have a little bit more in the way of resources to help support those children. Also, we have an increasing number of students who are English language learners in the state. This is extra money to make sure that that local systems are able to afford the services that that really those children might need but might not be necessary in a different school that didn't have any students who were learning English.
So is that sort of taken out of the budget when people are voting on their school budget or looking through their school budget? Those people who actually take the time to look through it, will they see the ESSA funds there, and are those sort of carved out then for how much a town is going to need to meet the budget requirements?
No, it wouldn't be broken out because what you would see is dollars in, but then you would see what you were hiring. And some of the teachers locally who were hired, for example, many systems have hired reading interventionists who actually benefit all students and provide, you know, additional targeted instruction. We know that some students, if they get very specific direct instruction in certain reading skills, it can be enough to help make the difference between being a reader and a not reader. So we do know that those are in the budgets. You would not be able to tell just from what was published. You would be able to see what came in. You might not know where it went. But that would be in a plan that we reviewed. But the larger question, unless you want to...
Well, I'm trying to figure out, and going to Marcus's question about how this impacts what taxpayers are paying. Let's say my town has a budget of $50 million for the school budget, and ESSA funds are part of that. So the federal government dollars that are going to the school to try to make sure that these plans are implemented is part of that. I guess the question is that sort of broken out separately, so it's sort of on top of the budget, coming in on top of it? Or are we basically saying, well, we've got some amount, 3 or 4% of that is coming from federal dollars, so the rest of it is coming from taxpayer dollars? You know, is it actually part of how you vote on a budget? Or when you say it's on top of, that makes it sound like maybe it's not even included in
the
budget.
No, it's included. My point is that the federal dollars can't support the initial investment in education. Every town has an obligation to provide for the education of its children. And if it educates them by operating a school, it has to run a whole school. It can't run a whole school minus an English teacher and then use the federal dollars to pay for the English teacher.
Okay.
So you provide your educational program, and to the extent that there are additional intervention services or support services that will help students succeed, particularly these historically disadvantaged students, that would be in your overall calculation. You would see the revenues in your town book, but it would not be in place of what is your local obligation to provide a good rounded education for your children. In terms of the spending per pupil, we do know that I don't think we are the highest at this point, but we're typically in the top 5 of high spending per pupil students. And part of that is a function of scale. We just run a lot smaller districts and a lot smaller schools than most states. And because of that, we don't have the efficiencies of scale that you might see in some contexts. One way that we're seeing some systems try to address this is through mergers of governance, which allow them to manage resources more strategically over a larger area and over a larger budget. And one of the challenges that some of our small schools have, if they stay, our small districts have, is if they're autonomous, is it's sometimes difficult to support the overhead cost of providing the overall system of supports, like all the kinds of different supports that might be necessary on any given day to help sure every child has support. So what we do see is that systems that are moving to scale or trying to become bigger systems are finding some opportunities to operate more efficiently and bring down their per pupil cost.
You know, Secretary Holcomb, we always talk about closing the achievement gap and the struggles. And I understand completely that this is always going to be a struggle because we're always trying to achieve the best for students. But what makes you think that this plan, or what can you point to in this plan that you think will really further that goal of making sure that every student succeeds? That's the whole name of the act, the Every Student Succeeds Act, that you can point to that you think Vermont is on the right path for actually closing some of those achievement gaps in?
So one of the things I'll first say, you know, and I think it's an ongoing factor because obviously we don't control the larger economic environment. Vermont's poverty rate for our children has doubled since 2008, and we haven't seen a huge tapering yet in performance. So that says something. You know, that says something about our schools. They are working hard to try to patch in supports and make sure that there's enough support there so children, even when they're terrible adverse family circumstances, can still thrive. So we need to pay attention and keep on that. And then the other thing that we're seeing is by paying attention to performance across even schools with similar demographics and seeing that variability, the fact that there is so much variability tells us that even within this state, we have some schools that have done really hard work and good thinking to figure out better ways to support our children, and we need to learn from them. We need to scale that out and share that knowledge and bring it to the systems that maybe are dealing with similar circumstances but haven't yet figured out that next level of work to help our kids.
Rebecca Holcomb is Vermont's Education Secretary. Thank you very much for talking with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And again, listeners, if you want to see more about the state education plan that was submitted to the federal government, you'll find the executive summary at vpr.net. Just click on Vermont Edition. Coming up, three men from our region are cycling from the southern tip of South America all the way to Vermont. We'll catch up with them a few months into their journey next on Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The Spanish phrase mundo pequeño means small world. It's also the name and the mission of a massive undertaking by three cyclists from our region. Cameron Russell, Noah McCarter, and Eli Bennett are bicycling 12,000 miles across the Americas. Here's their route.
Started pedaling from Ushuaia, Argentina, down in Tierra del Fuego. We sort of weave back and forth between Argentina and Chile, and then we'll head north and go into Bolivia and then Peru, Ecuador, Colombia, and then we'll have to take a boat to Panama and then go all the way through Central America and then up through the States back to New England.
Phew. Along the way, they are blogging and photographing their experiences from the saddles of their bikes and forging connections with the people and landscapes they encounter. We talked to them recently. They're in Valparaíso, Chile. They're almost 3 months and 3,000 miles into this epic bike trip. And I asked them, how did they go from an ambitious daydream to actually making this adventure happen?
This is Eli here. Yeah, one thing we've recognized is how lucky we are to find two other people, each of us, that are willing to do this trip and the time schedules with our lives. We're definitely thankful that we're all here. Because we wouldn't want to do this by ourselves. So,
Also three people who can get along for that long. And are you still friends a couple months in?
Yeah. All of us, yes, we're still friends.
Noah had something too.
Yeah, I'd just like to add that even though we do face a lot of challenges being together all the time, we're eating together, we're sleeping together, we're riding all day together. Basically, it'd be like a relationship.
We have a shared bank account.
Like, we don't get much of a break from each other's company. But even though, like, all those challenges are present, we have to work through that and have good communication. We're 3 months in and we're still doing great.
Tell me a story about an experience that highlights what this adventure is like for you.
This is Noah again. We met a young Argentinian guy named Andres, he was cycling in the same direction as we were. And he joined us for a while, and his willingness to share his ideas and connect with us and his excitement over hearing what we were doing and his desire to support us and just his friendship dealing with the three crazy Americans, as he labeled us.
How's your Spanish?
Our Spanish is definitely a mixed bag. Cameron speaks the most Spanish and is, I would say, conversational. My Spanish is not as good, but it's improving rapidly. We've all been improving. Eli is...
My Spanish is very bad. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd just like to say that even though there is a language barrier a lot of the time, it hasn't stood between us connecting with people.
Jane, this is Cameron again. I just wanted to just go back on your question about, you know, people we've met. We've met many, many people who we've shared short experiences with, you know, on the side of the road, who say, you know, here's a bottle of juice and some fruit, take it, you know. Or we had a woman in Lanco, Chile, who had a hospedaje that she normally would rent rooms for 10 to 12,000 pesos, you know, which is $15 or so a person. And it was a bit out of our price range per person, but she just decided, before we could say anything else, give us the 4 rooms for the quarter of the price. And basically was saying that seeing young people, you know, doing something like this and taking it upon themselves to have an adventure and get out there is something that she really wanted to support. And so there are plenty of stories of those types of experiences.
You know, you must be in some ways at the mercy of strangers to help shape this adventure. But I imagine because you're cycling, you're really also at the mercy of the weather and road conditions. And that must be such a challenge.
This is Noah again. Yeah, we've faced some challenges for sure with the conditions. You know, the winds in Tierra del Fuego were incredible and we were riding against them. The road conditions are often horrible. They're basically like four-wheeler tracks at some point, or the worst back road, dirt road that you could imagine back in the States. And we're climbing the Andes Mountains often on those roads. Sometimes it's really dusty because the cars are going by and it's dry and they're blowing dust every time they go by, or it's pouring rain and they're slick and running, and those challenges are definitely present.
Are you guys able to keep that fun in the moment? Because there's a lot of fun looking back on challenges like that, but in the moment, it can really feel like a slog.
Yeah, this is Eli here. I really enjoy biking. Anyone who knows me knows that about me. So I've really enjoyed, you know, the terrible conditions. we've joked, and this is kind of like an outdoor term, but there's a couple different types of fun. And type one fun is fun that in the moment you're having a great time, you know. That's the day when the tailwind is pushing us along the nice paved road and it's just beautiful out. That's type one fun. And on those really bad days where the roads are dirt and gravel and it's raining, that's when we get into the type two fun, where it's not really fun in the moment, but we look back and we're like, oh yeah, that was worth it. And those are the days that we really remember. And I think for years to come, we'll be thinking back about, you know, the day we all ended up in the little cabin on the Carretera Austral, raining all day. We were cold. It's probably in the 40s or 50s, and we were wet. You know, we had everything we needed to be safe and survive the night, but it definitely was uncomfortable. It was just an abandoned cabin with the windows busted out and stuff. A fire in the stove, even though there was no stove pipe. And then we were battling with our eyes tearing up because of the smoke inside. You know, probably not the best decision, but that was some memorable type two fun where we look back and we think, oh yeah, that was worth it. That was a real experience. Those are the days that I definitely look back on with fond memories.
You know, when you describe this trip on your website, you talk about wanting to sort of affirm your faith in humanity through these travels. Are you finding that?
This is Eli here. For me, it's been really great for me to leave the U.S. and see it firsthand that, you know, people in Argentina and Chile and all these little towns along the Carretera Austral, we have so much in common, and that people are just are good in general. And so,
yeah, no, I had something too.
Yeah, I want to jump in here and say that, and before this trip, in the past year leading up to it, and watching what was going on in politics and in the media, I think I speak for all of us when I say, like, sometimes you just feel helpless to take action or to make a difference. And this trip for us has become a way to do something we love and raise awareness through that, to share the stories of connection, of breaking down the differences between people and seeing the similarities instead, and focusing on the humanity instead of, you know, we're facing language differences, cultural differences. Any one of these small towns we run into, you would think there'd be so many things standing between us connecting with the local fishermen there or something, just in terms of our lives. But, you know, with a smile and a few words, there's connection and this shared humanity.
Jane, this is Cameron again. For me, in thinking about this trip and, you know, the name Small World in Spanish, and, you know, one of the questions that I find myself asking on a weekly basis is, you know, with what Noah said, can we show something impactful? Can we evidence this goodness that we're confident that we share with people, regardless of their, you know, sex, race, nationality, culture, etc. And so the hope is that, you know, if we set it up as much as possible beforehand and sort of had to be accountable to that, maybe when we get home and we have a bunch of videos and stories and photos, that we can find a way to share this, you know, this experience and this message in a way that positively affects other folks too. So
we'll wait to see what that turns into in the end. But, you know, the important question is, what kind of celebration have you planned for when you reach Vermont, whenever that actually winds up happening?
This is Eli. Me and Cameron, actually, I think this
we thought this through.
about a month ago, we were already talking about the planning, because we're very, we want to have a plan for everything. And
we're pretty A-type person.
No, not so much. He's a good sport about it.
but I think we're talking about maybe we'll all gather and, you know, be able to ride into Burlington or Montpelier together. This is Cameron. We'll probably have a big gathering of family and friends, and we'll ride up to the Canadian border together and maybe get a ride back to the house after that. We do have some support from folks at OGE and Old Spokes Home, and some support from meaning some socks and some sunglasses from Darn Tough Socks and Jumbo Sunglasses, respectively. We have some folks to thank, and, you know, hopefully some folks to celebrate with when we get back.
I can't wait to keep following the trip as you move northward and follow your trip.
This is Eli again. Maybe a few weeks from now, we'll be starting up the Lagoon Route in Bolivia. That'll be a section where we'll probably be the most remote throughout the whole trip. And we have to carry 10 days of food, and there's only water every 2 days. So that's something that maybe you and other listeners can look forward to watching on Instagram.
Sounds like a lot of type 2 fun.
Yeah, a lot of type 2 fun.
Yeah, yep.
Yeah, we'll definitely keep an eye on it. You guys,
right. Best
of luck. Que onda.
Gracias.
That was Cameron Russell, Noah McCarter, and Eli Bennett. We talked over an internet connection. They are just about 3 months into a 10-month bike ride from Tierra del Fuego to Vermont. Their photos and blog posts from the trip are incredible. We've shared a link to their website on our show page at vpr.net. And that's our show for today. If you have a comment you'd like to share, leave us a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. You can also find us on Facebook or tweet us at Vermont Edition. And follow Vermont Edition in NPR One for our latest content. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gale Rosen, and Meg Malone. Jake Rusnak directed this program. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.